All right, welcome back, everyone. I'm so glad to see the lively conversation in the break, and I know we'll have much more of a chance to continue it. Most immediately, with the great lineup of speakers that we have on stage here, when UState started, our vision of success was to, quote-unquote, understand the conditions for the sustainable delivery of saving services that can substantially improve the life chances of low-income youth in the developing world, and to transfer this knowledge to those in a position to support their accessibility and quality. That is what we officially set out to do. And this morning, you've heard what we've learned about how youth savings accounts offered through commercial banks can affect the life chances of those youth. So now, we're going to talk to some of those people in a position to continue supporting their availability, accessibility, and quality, and find out how Youth Save Learning fit with their efforts to promote financial inclusion, well-being, and economic development. And to the extent that their work could benefit from asset building for young people, the speakers seated here each represent a potential pathway to scale for youth savings accounts. So this discussion is going to focus also on exploring each of those. Their impressive bios have all been listed on the event's webpage, but let me just take a moment to introduce each of them briefly right now. To my immediate left, we have Herhard Klitzday. Yes, okay. He's a senior specialist at CCAP, where he leads the Customer Centricity Initiative, which guides financial service providers to customer-centric business models that will advance financial inclusion. Herhard is a Renaissance man whose background includes commercial banking, consulting, academia, and government service, so he'll be able to provide us with a multifaceted perspective indeed. And then seated to his left, we have Kelly Hallman, who is a senior associate at the Population Council, where she conducts research on how to increase the education, livelihood, and sexual and reproductive health choices of marginalized groups, especially girls. She's authored numerous publications, which you can find on the Population Council website, I go there often, and which I highly recommend, including several on adolescent girls in South Africa and the SSRC/UNESCO volume on the fourth wave, an assault on women, gender, culture, and HIV in the 21st century. Next, we have Janet Gordon, who is an Associate Director for Community Affairs at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation of the United States, in the Division of Depositor and Consumer Protection, where she oversees the Regional Community Affairs Program, which, among other things, encourages partnerships for economic inclusion among banks, government, and other organizations. Her team is also responsible for the FDIC's Money Smart Financial Education Curriculum for youth and other demographic groups. And finally, we have Suzanne Lee from USAID's Office of Education. Suzanne has worked on youth workforce development, education finance, and policy issues in developing countries for the past 10-plus years at USAID. In her current role, she focuses on soft skills, employability measurements, public-private partnerships, scale and sustainability of USAID's education program, innovative financing, and cost-effectiveness as related to the agency's education strategy goals. Please join me in welcoming our panelists. So, Herhard, let me start with you. CGAP's role in YouthSave was to explore the so-called business case. So, tell us what you found out. Is there a business case?
No.
Are you done? Okay.
Firstly, thanks for inviting me, Arnie. I really appreciate an opportunity to sort of elaborate a bit more than what we've published and learned here. And secondly, I think it's important to state up front that I'm a latecomer to YouthSave. I'm a newbie. I've joined about 18 months ago, and I learned a lot in the process, and I'm impressed with the discussion we had today. But let me get to your question. Like a good economist always answers, there's always two sides to the story, or several sides. And in the publication, we identified those sides in terms of whether there's a business case, what are the assumptions underlying it. And then we also elaborated on how you actually go about thinking about this business case going through different levels of decisions. But what I want to do today is I want to elaborate a little bit about four things. One is whether you follow a product-centric versus a customer-centric approach and how that affects the business case. Secondly, what are the main drivers when everything else sort of falls to the dust? What are the main drivers that we have to look at? Thirdly, I want to think about technology and partnerships. We've mentioned partnerships and technology this morning already. And fourthly, I want to just finish my few remarks with a remark on value. And when I refer to value, I'm referring to value at different levels, but I'll come to that. So firstly, a product-centric versus a customer-centric focus. If you follow a product-centric focus, your business case starts to work when you actually focus on a segment of the youth, which we call the working youth. So then you have higher account activity, you work with larger amounts, quite often you see higher retained balances, and you would have seen snippets of this in some of the slides that were shown. So as soon as you do that and you want to make a product work, a youth safe product, then you have to look at those requirements. But if you take the customer-centric route, or route as we say in South Africa, we have a different approach. There, what we are looking at is whether you see this youth as a lifetime customer. Because I'm speaking now as a financial service provider. Right? This is the point of entry here in this discussion. So if you see the customer as a lifetime customer, you look at lifetime value, then it's not only one product or one customer. You can look at banking the family. You can look at a range of products over the lifetime. And those we've seen, if you take that approach, that is the real business case. And the third thing I want to say about the customer lifetime value is that there is a major proviso, major qualification. You have to retain the customer. And unless you do that, that will also not work. So customer retention is massively important. And I've mentioned two things of importance now within this differentiation. Retention and also segmentation, as I mentioned earlier, so you exactly know who you are working with. Now, retention is also a function of how well you design what you are offering the customer. And you would have heard this morning a range of insights on what should be included in design of this product that you are offering to you. And that is also an important consideration. If I can quickly go to drivers, indication when I'm going on for too long. If I can quickly go to drivers, you know, when everything else sort of go down the drain, there are three drivers that you have to think about. Scale, cost, and the activity that you see on the account. And how do you drive that? And I think what is important on the scale is not just how many people you have, but how do you reach the people? And you've heard this sort of reaching them through schools, sort of group-based, through partners. And I think that is a major portion of what makes a business case work. Because if this was a brick-and-mortar branch-based approach, I can tell you up front, you are wasting your time. Up front. We've seen it in the evidence. We see it all over. And we don't have to look far to get to that conclusion. Now, on the cost side, it's an interesting one. To reach youth customers is a costly exercise. Even if you go to schools and you work through schools or you work through partners, you have lots of transport costs, you have staff involved, you've got marketing costs, etc. And therefore, it's important to see how you can actually cut those costs in terms of the methodologies that you use. I just want to mention you one set of figures quickly. To open account in most parts of the world, including in the countries that we have looked at, but I do not know about Nepal, is normally around about $20 total activity-based costing per account. $20. To naught minutes. Thank you. Okay. In naught minutes, I'm going to tell you two more points. So, to actually open that same account by using remote devices can go down as low as $10 if it's your own staff. But if you work with partner staff, it can go down as low as to as $2 a cup, just as a sort of indication. And that brings me to my third point, which now is going to be my last point, and that is technology and partnerships. So technology was not a major portion of the work during the YouthSafe program period, except in Colombia, where technology was used to reach clients with messages. But I think there is a great sort of value in terms of applying technology here, applying mobile device technology, also with the qualification. Not all children have access to this kind of means, and but parents do. So technology and partnerships, those are two drivers that can really sort of make business cases work. And I'm going to stop here, and I'll come back in the questions on the value.
Perfect. Thank you, Herman. Our next speaker, Kelly, comes at the question of reaching marginalized young people with financial services from a somewhat different perspective. Kelly, can you tell us a little bit more about what you have learned, what Population Council has learned about improving the situation of marginalized young girls with both financial and reproductive health services, and what the role of savings might be in that, according to your experience?
Sure. I'm going to go up to the podium because I have some papers to shuffle, and I think holding the mic and shuffling papers at the same time will not work out well.
Hello? Yeah, okay, great. So, Ronnie, thanks for the invitation, and thank you for those of you who are still here in the room. I know there was a drop-off at the break. So I wanted to really focus on the results of the YouthSafe experiment, which was impressive and vast and a long-term one, which many projects are not. So it's really just so admirable in that respect to begin with. What things I saw from reading the report and how they resonate with our work with adolescent girls, particularly vulnerable adolescent girls in low and middle income countries at the Population Council. So I'd like to focus my remarks on two specific age segments. So we found in most of our programming, research around programming as well, that a narrow age range for whatever the particular program or product is usually the most effective because people have very different needs at different stages in their lives. And so first I would like to talk about 10 to 14-year-olds. And so on this slide that is up now, this is from a forthcoming publication that colleagues and I are doing on very young adolescents, which are defined as 10 to 14-year-olds. And so I just happen to have these numbers at hand, but I think they're relevant for what we're talking about today. So the YouthSafe experiment, if I understand correctly, was 12 to 18-year-olds mostly in school. And so I just wanted to show you, this is demographic and health survey data, the most recent data available from each particular country where the survey was done. And these are regional averages that I'm showing you here. And if you look at the first column here, a vast number, in fact, majorities of young people live in rural areas, so that has implications for access. The next column talks about young people who have, and this is a very young age, at 10 to 14, they have at least one parent deceased. And you can see it's relatively high across the board, but particularly in Eastern and Southern Africa, almost 20% of young people have one parent who's completely missing from their lives because of disease, violence, et cetera, dangerous work. If you look at the next set of columns here, the percent living with neither parent, upwards of a quarter to almost a third in some of these Eastern and Southern African countries are not living with either parent. Many are not attending school, particularly in West and Central Africa. So you can really see here that in terms of access to savings, some of the barriers that were brought out in the YouthSafe experiment For instance, the age requirements in different countries. You can, 16 was good. In Colombia, it was what, 6 or 8 years old? 7, thank you. Lowering that age requirement is, I think, really important to increase access, and also finding a workaround for the parental co-signatory requirement is a really important one, too. And I know you experimented with alternative adults, teachers, other trusted people in the community. So I think that's really super important, particularly because so many people simply don't have one or both of their parents in their lives, or they're not living with them, et cetera. And I would encourage in the next round of this, if there is a next round, to go a little bit younger, because as you can see from some of the stats in the next columns is a lot of young people are not in school to begin with, even when they're 10 to 14 years old, and a lot of them are behind grade for age and at very, very high risk for dropout. So those people, after 14, many of them are not going to make it to lower secondary school. So I think the primary school, maybe grades 5, 6, would be a great target, the 10 to 14-year-olds, and also, to the extent possible, doing this outside of school, too. I know that's much harder because of the platforms through which you deliver it are less obvious, but there are platforms in many developing countries. So if I don't need that slide anymore, done with that. So if I could just move on to a few more points. The lack of ID documents was another really big one that I understood from the research. And we've found this as well in our research that particularly for girls, lack of identification documents really limits access to savings, financial services in general, also different livelihood opportunities, different social safety net programs, education opportunities, et cetera. So getting this ID document to girls is really, really, really key. And so I think that's one that could really be worked on in the next round of whatever this might be. Another thing that I noticed, and it really resonates with the work that we're doing, is the limited physical access of girls to some of the banking branches, to different places you have to go to get the services. And we found in our research that for young people, when they're before the age of puberty, basically when they're between 10 and 14 years old, girls and boys have about equal spatial access around their neighborhoods in the community. But at puberty, when girls start to become perceived as sexual beings, they're at higher risk for sexual assault, they have men, whatever, and places are unsafe for them. Places they used to be able to go as a girl child are now unsafe for them because they're seen as a woman, they're seen as a sexual object. And so in research that I've done personally in South Africa in both rural areas and in urban areas, we mapped spaces that young people can go. We had them each tell us in groups, girl groups, boy groups, older, younger. When girls get to puberty, their accessible space in the community is a quarter to a third that of boys. So at grade 8, 9, boys have this space, girls have this space. Whereas when they're younger, they all have equal space. And so that, I think, is another piece of really looking at gender and age and how those really have impacts for what services can be accessed. I know I'm running out of time, so let me just make another couple points here. So another piece of research that I did recently in Tanzania, and this is asking girls about what services and institutions in the community they have access to. And across the board, they did not have access to any savings whatsoever, none. There were a couple that said, I have, there's this place where we can get like a little loan for our petty trading, for our small business, but there was no savings whatsoever. When there was, it was, oh, they cater to women, but they don't allow girls. Or they cater to people who are in school, but, girls who are out of school, who've dropped out, who have all these responsibilities, that we can't access the service. And so the out-of-school girls who are between 15 and 19 are another really vulnerable group. And getting more access, on behalf of them is really, really important. And these same girls, when we asked them about their livelihood strategies, it was basically petty trading, selling peanuts, etc., to primary kids at recess, to their neighbors in the neighborhood, and basically sexual liaisons with different types of men. We asked them, and they reported 12 different types of sexual partners that they go to for different reasons, to pay the rent, to get, you know, food for their children, etc. And so really expanding the financial access and other types of access to these girls is really super important. And I know a lot of the lessons from your experiment are so incredibly relevant. So I hope when either of us go forward with another project, we can really talk to each other and have some mutual learning. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kelly. Janet, I know that you've also seen the way access barriers play out for youth in youth savings, but in the U.S. Can you tell us about how FDIC is learning about these issues and any parallels you may have seen with the international experience?
Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's more evidence to me that this is a small world, so I'm glad to be here. The FDIC has a long-standing commitment to financial education as the U.S. Insurer of consumer deposits in the banking system, and financial capability as one element of our focus on economic inclusion in that mainstream financial system. So in the past 2 years, we've had a particular focus on youth, both as a committee of financial and government enterprises in Washington meets regularly and starts to talk about strategies targeted to youth, and because of the data that we find in our own survey about youth being banked or unbanked. And banked youth have a savings or a checking account. Unbanked youth have neither a savings nor any kind of transaction account offered by a mainstream financial institution. So we conduct a survey every 2 years, household survey in conjunction with the Census Bureau, and that data provides the foundation for what we do at the FDIC in terms of understanding who has a bank account, how they use it, what other financial services they use, and how we might improve access. Usually we aggregate it at the household level. We took some extra steps to look at how youth are served by the system right now. So this might be a surprise to people thinking about the U.S. as a very advanced country, right? So what do we see here? We see that a large proportion of very young people just don't have a savings or a checking account. And we see that as people get older, they do seem to get savings accounts, but we have no insurance that the people who are young now are later going to look like the people who are older now, right? Because right now, as we know, there are many options, good, bad, and indifferent, for young people to conduct financial activities. So we don't know the answer to what's going to happen, but we would like to help influence it. And this is further elaboration by income. So you can obviously see that even people of age, 18 to 24, there is a significant unbanked population, which is significantly related to income. So our strategies really focus on our findings. One of the things we've done is to recognize that many banks have activities both in financial education and in school programs, and we wanted to understand what works and what doesn't work. It's not a randomized sample. It's not a highly structured, but basically it's a pilot initiative for us to understand the current status of what's happening in schools. And the pilot is about a year and a half old and will end at the end of this school year. So we are really tracing the work of 21 banks who link financial education and youth savings accounts in a variety of ways, generally through work with the schools. And we're looking at different topics. We're trying to pay attention to some of the very same topics that you're looking at in other countries, which is, you know, how do you get into schools? How do you find the influencers in schools? In other words, just going into the school doesn't mean that people are giving you credibility. It's earning credibility. How do you influence people during the school day or after school? Who are your partners? And just like you, we are looking at the dormancy and the use of the account. What are the characteristics of the savings accounts that really make a difference, including the incentives that are often offered to make deposits? And the timeliness, if it's once a week, does it make a difference? If it's once a month that you have in-bank banking at school? And we really haven't prescribed any particular approach. So we have banks, 21 banks with different approaches. One bank has a very elaborate system for branches in a few schools. That includes training young people. It's really a developmental activity for young people, and they become bankers, which is a whole different way of looking at this, providing income, providing a future. Others just have banking in school, so once a week, once a month, in different ways, in different locations. Others really require people to go outside the school to make the deposit. The education is in the school, but you still have to go to the bank. And others have various arrangements with nonprofits. So we are looking at different models. So we'll have a qualitative discussion for these banks about how these models may or may not work. And it's interesting that the issues we're finding are some of the same issues everyone has been talking about today. So getting into this school and establishing a good relationship, that initial hurdle, I know it took months in some of the countries you're talking about. It took a lot of time individually for many of these banks, or in some cases hometown banks for these communities and these schools. Sometimes they get in by being on the board of the school, you know, the school board, or by knowing the principal who's the next door neighbor. It is not a very routine thing. Another thing we've been looking at are some of the particular context issues that you find. We find them in the U.S. too. So here there are 50 states. And all the states have different rules about how to the relative legal status of minors. And that can be a barrier or an opportunity depending on how banks look at those barriers, look at those requirements. We also have similar issues with, we have identity requirements in the U.S., pretty strong ones in terms of understanding who you're doing business with. But obviously, working in schools with young people has a different risk profile than your average consumer or business customer. So we're recognizing that, and in fact, all of the agencies worked together in the past year, just in February, if you want to see a agency response, to put out interagency questions and answers to clarify how we view many of the regulatory, the federal regulatory framework that impacts youth accounts. So we actually did this as an interagency question and answer initiative. It doesn't address all the state rules, but it addresses the federal rules. And there is no federal age of minor, age of ability to open accounts. There is none. So the other thing we've noticed is that banks and schools struggle with the mechanics of opening accounts, maintaining accounts. How to do it cost effectively. What's the business case? But it's more really how do we do this as efficiently as possible? And we are trying to work with the banks on that and hopefully gather data on it. And finally, the engagement of two important groups that are not the school or the bank are parents and caregivers and peers. How many of you have teenagers who just won't listen to you? You know, you don't think they're listening to you, but actually parents turn out to be, our research tells us, a huge influence on the financial behavior of their kids. So we have a special focus as part of our new financial education curriculum to engage the parents. So we have a side-by-side parent caregiver guide, for example, to all four grade levels. We have all four grade levels with different lessons and different parent guides. But also in this youth savings pilot with the banks, we are experimenting with how to engage with the parents. Similarly, how to engage with peers. How do you use the school's communication, informal communication network, to talk about savings? The bank that implements in-school branches actually uses peers to educate and market. And that is a very interesting approach, sort of like your theater idea, but, you know, at the youth level. So in the next year, we will be completing our qualitative data collection, and we are collecting information on the number of accounts, but not on the detailed characteristics of account holders. And we'll be talking to institutions and their partners, so we will be publishing a report probably at the end of 2016. And I think we will be dealing with some of these same issues and also having the great opportunity to move forward with additional research and perhaps with some guidance and support to financial institutions who want to do this better. And we hope that's the case. So I really appreciate being invited. I learned a lot that we can feed into our future research. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. So we know from our work that savings can be important in helping kids reach higher levels of schooling, but our next speaker is going to tell us a little bit about the role that savings might play in helping kids reach higher levels of schooling and employment. Suzanne, can you talk a little bit about, I know USAID is keenly interested in that connection, about how to help young people access tertiary education and really market-relevant learning opportunities. Can you tell us a little bit about what you see as the potential connection between youth savings and that area of work?
Yeah, so if I could just give a context coming out of the education sector, because many of you all here are from, I believe, on the financial side, on the economic growth piece of things. And so at USAID, we have education outside, in addition to our youth policy, which kind of a big push for cross-sectoral work, knowing that, you know, with youth development, you have to have a holistic intervention. With that in mind, we have then an education strategy that's nested under that youth policy. And under that education strategy, we have three goals. And in that three goals, in fact, two out of the three goals specifically talks about youth. And it's particularly youth in conflict and crisis affected areas. And secondly, on youth in terms of increasing earnings and having job placement, greater workforce development. So in that area, I just it was really interesting. I enjoyed it so much reading all the findings that USAID did, and to see like the cross multidimensional impact that this can have, right? And specifically in the education side, we have huge issues of something that my colleague on the Population Council already noted, but issues of retention, especially the transition from the elementary to the middle school, and especially for girls. There's a huge drop-off, and that doesn't surprise me, with the low, in some places where you don't have as much female participation in the savings, if you're doing it in school, because in at the middle school there's a huge drop-off there, where they're, because of early marriages, as we all know, and other reasons. And so you have this, so I was thinking, oh, the savings could potentially, I was really curious to see increase what the thresholds are, how much dollar amount do you need savings to increase retention. So one of the top issues in the education side, we know with the reason why kids don't have access or they have problems with retention, the number one reason is economics. It's the opportunity cost. Is that they need, you know, they need to help out for the girls, they need to help out at the household level, and so it's not as worthwhile then for to send the guy to school, and then just paying, it's not, although we say free education, free primary education in Africa and other places, it actually is not free, and the household bears a large burden of it, whether it be school uniforms, to food, etc. And so given that, I was just thinking, oh, it would be interesting to look more closely at this, how the savings could potentially help in retention, in completion, those type of things. Another area that we've been working at USAID is looking specifically at soft skills, especially in the youth area. And soft skills could mean transferable skills, non-cognitive skills, and as we all know in the employment area, that all employers said there's a skills gap, right? And they're saying the skills gap in large part is like, listen, we have a lot of jobs out there, but we don't have the right fit, right? And a lot of it is what we don't have employees that have critical thinking, that have problem solving, that come on time, et cetera, right? So one of the things what we've been doing at USA, we have doing all the commissioning of research in the soft skills area, and we've identified what soft skills linked directly to employment and earnings. And we've identified five of them that we found that and that potentially links to this whole USAVE work, and that is the five skills are social skills, communication skills, higher order thinking skills, which is like problem solving, decision making, critical thinking. And actually the last two of the five soft skills are more directly with the youth literature, youth development literature, and that is self-control and positive self-development, which is self-efficacy, self-esteem. And so I was thinking, oh, the savings, it'd be interesting to look and doing further research how the savings could potentially either help increase those soft skills, especially in self-control and problem solving, as well as kind of self-efficacies that I was kind of hearing in some of the presentations earlier on. So it's, when I see this, I said there's a lot of potential integration, especially when you're working with youth, whether with education as well as with employment.
I can take it and say we are doing exactly that kind of research right now, so we hope to have results on it in a few, 18 months. Great. Well, thank you so much. I am going to exercise the moderator's privilege and ask one question before we open it up to those on the webinar and also those in the room. So do be thinking of your questions, please. But one cross-cutting theme I heard across these very diverse, otherwise diverse perspectives is the whole question of maybe accessing or reaching the really the most vulnerable and the most marginalized young people, those who are out of school, those who are not connected to the kinds of mass aggregation platforms that actually make it easiest to reach them in a commercial way. Obviously the schools are the number one platform that come to mind. And so I would love to hear sort of from each of you where you think that balance lies, and what is the role of organizations like yours in helping to kind of bridge what otherwise could be a chasm? So, for example, Herhart, you talked about lowering costs and addressing key drivers to get to scale. Is that a strategy that's valid for really marginalized kids, or are we talking, that's a strategy that's sort of more valid for this main actionable segment, but not necessarily for the kids that fall outside of those tech-enabled platforms?
I've been singled out there. I'll have to respond. Rani, I don't have an answer specific for marginalized kids, for kids that sort of we don't have a reach through parents or schools or workplace, etc. But I'm just thinking of some of the work CGAP is doing in terms of reaching other marginalized communities. Think about women farmers in real remote areas. And in that instance, we're also looking at the use of technology, the use of partnerships. And I think once you understand the reality of people on the ground and where they do aggregate, where they do meet points of contact, where they sort of where you can contact them, you start seeing solutions. So I would go and look in that area for answers to these questions, but I don't have a vivid example that I can share with you. And I just want to add one thing. We all look at the sort of point of view of the financial service provider. But if you turn it around and you look at the point of view of the customer or the consumer, then you also have to ask sort of what cost they have to incur to be served as well. And when you are in a very marginalized situation, you're actually in the worst position, but you have to incur more cost to be served. And we have to start understanding that and see how we react to that rather than look at people from a service provider and a cost-to-serve kind of approach. But all I can say at this stage about that.
Thanks. Other thoughts?
All right.
in here. All right. A thought was when in education, when I think about the most marginalized, it has to be kind of a cross-cutting, working with variety of actors, right? Especially the NGOs who have direct contact, or the community liaison that had community direct contact. And I think maybe it's not a commercial venture, right? It's a development venture to see it from that perspective. So using maybe savings and loans, a different kind of platform altogether, instead of connection with a bank, that it would make sense. Piggy bank, something a different, as if you're looking at a lower age group, right, a younger age group to work with that. But I think with the most marginalized, I can't imagine without working in more of a holistic fashion with other, whether it be, I think about our alternative learning programs that we have when we work with the most marginalized. We have systems where we work with youth who have dropped out and they want to get like something like a GED equivalent to have an accelerated, what we call accelerated learning program. So it's through those where you could reach out to the most marginalized with these like savings type of programs. So I see more of an integration of finding other places where, like the social sectors, whether it be in the health or in the education, where we do work with those folks, and how do you, and what are those platforms in targeting those most marginalized?
You know, the idea of integrated services is really integral to financial inclusion in the U.S. as well. Big initiative under the Workforce Opportunity and Act and Innovation Act to integrate savings and financial education, particularly, into summer youth employment, which does have a targeted foundational role, but also into all kinds of social services, everything, including multi-generational efforts. I mean, it is getting to the parents from the youth and the youth from the parents. So all of those kinds of social services that provide income and education and training support can integrate financial capability elements, and that is really where it has to be done.
Hello. Okay, there we go. In our work with adolescent girls in low and middle income countries, what we found is, particularly for those out of school and very vulnerable who are basically just trying to scrape together a living, is they do go to the health center, so that's a place to access them. They go to the market, because many of them are petty traders. They go to the market almost every day to get whatever it is they're selling on the street. They also go to water access points, and they also go to transport hubs. So those are the four places where you find very vulnerable adolescent girls. So those are starting points for us in a lot of our programming.
That's really interesting. I think that can hold a lot of promise in terms of thinking sort of out of box and how to reach very marginalized populations, but even potentially at scale. Why don't I turn it over to Usman now? I think that there are a couple of questions coming in from the web.
Yep, thank you, Rani. Yes, again, we had some interesting discussion on the webinar as well. On the same topic, Indra had a question with regards to limited access for girls. Can someone elaborate on partnerships with other organizations ability to help create safer environments for girls? And a sort of related question by Atta saying, I'm curious to know as to what type of outreach is being done, has been done in raising awareness amongst men, be it through community groups, religious organizations. These are the two things on that theme. And another one was on slightly different tangent. Are there any thoughts on how financial literacy education can or will impact job readiness of youth, especially where employment is
happening? Great, thank you. Suzanne. Can I talk to the one on financial education and job readiness?
No, the specific question was, if you could,
the last question?
Yeah. And on
So, I mean, it was interesting just looking at the USAID report. So financial literacy and education, of course, can help, right? But it's what type of financial literacy and education, what type of information. I think when a question came up, what is it? And so just from reading the USAVE, it seems like the more specific guidance on budget, how you do budgets, expense. I mean, I found that to be true even when I was working with the affordable private school sector. Financial literacy was a huge piece in terms of finding out how do you set up an account, how do you do a budget from what comes in and what comes out, and taking into account something very simple and low key, and then looking and saying, oh my goodness, I spent so much money on this petty cash, and I should really take into account these things. So it does help. Another question is whether it works, and I think another colleague here was sharing that it hasn't been shown as effective in the school. It is more, because one of the questions I had, because I know in the U.S. education, like in elementary school, they incorporate that in the curriculum. So the question I'm curious to hear from on the U.S. side, you know, if there's any impact from that to be, but it seems like from the bankable chart there of like of actual savings, it doesn't seem like that has a great impact there.
Sure. And it's hard to follow behaviors. It's not as hard to demonstrate knowledge and skills improvement, which we do see, but the actual tracking of behaviors to education, just like you're finding, is very difficult to track and analyze. And quite frankly, we have sort of mixed results. It's not, so we have done some longitudinal studies, fairly rigorous ones, knowledge skills clearly improved. Behavior is much harder to demonstrate, so that's, you know, just a difficult area of research. One we would like to see more research in.
The person on the web, the New America Foundation, New America did an interesting paper a few years ago on this question, actually, sort of thinking about how can financial capability, and we like to use that framework because it includes both education that targets knowledge and skills and attitudes, and access, which really directly targets behavior, how both of those components can change mental habits. And I think we can throw this up on the web later, but I think that there's several pathways traced in that paper that are very relevant to job readiness skills in terms of developing critical thinking, and especially in terms of developing self-regulation and tolerance for delayed gratification, which are so important in the workplace, as we can all attest, I think. Kelly, can I get you to talk a little bit about the Partnerships for Girls and Awareness for Men?
Yes, and the safety aspect as well. I think that was part of the question too. Safety for girls. Yeah, so what we normally do is we work with usually a local NGO that has been on the ground for a long time, and usually with a governmental partner too, often the Department of Health, the Department of Education, to plan a program or evaluate and then improve an existing program. To speak specifically on the safety aspect for girls, what we've done is we have used the results that we have collected in our research about where, when, and how different places in the community are unsafe for girls. We've shared them with intersectoral committees at the local level, community planning boards, the people who are responsible for infrastructure, police, et cetera, and really try to get a sort of multi-sectoral holistic approach to guarding, you know, securing different places, making them safer. We also work specifically with girls on safety practices, so walking to school not by yourself but with another girl, with two other girls, things that you can do to be safer, and also a safety plan. In particular, if X happens to you, if this thing happens to you, this is what I'm going to do. This is who I'm going to call. If things are dangerous at home, this is where I can go sleep. This is a safe place I can go. So a very specific plan. If these things happen to me, which happen to girls a lot, this is what I'm going to do. So it's not a panic when a bad thing happens. It's a, okay, this is my plan. So those are the things that we've done, and they're showing some effect for girls.
Safe Spaces project that you had in Kenya and other places really aims to create that safe physical environment for at least a few hours a week where girls can go, feel safe, build social capital, but then also build financial capital through associated savings activities. And I think that that's an approach we would all endorse.
Yeah, that's a really big one for girls, especially girls who are vulnerable and don't go often to a place where they can learn and share and discuss and feel safe. So we try to find some physical space, as Ronnie said, and have the girls come every week on a specific day at a specific time. It's not a drop-in thing. It's we expect you here on this day and this time. And if you're not here, we know there's something going wrong. There's something happening in your life, and we're going to go check on you. And so that's the approach that we've used and found it quite effective.
There's much more to say on this, but I want to open it up for questions for the audience.
Hi, my name is Rachel from PLAN, working on the Banking on Change program, which is a youth savings group program. Everything you've said has resonated. It's been fascinating that young people can save if you take the group to them, if you engage their parents, if you segment by age, if you deliver engaging training and so on. But one element that we've noticed in particular is the motivation that young people get from saving together, for the social capital, from being in a group, from seeing their peers saving, from setting savings goals together. And I'm wondering, first of all, if you have experience of that too in your program. And then secondly, a follow-up question, I think particularly for Kelly. We've been hopeful that by including girls in our savings group, that their risky behaviour might reduce because they have other sources of income, other sources of capital. But is there a risk that the peer pressure to save might increase their risky behaviour? I'll let you take that first, yeah.
So on the second part of your question, they're really... There have been some early experiments where it, with girls, and particularly out-of-school girls, it wasn't savings per se that made their behavior more risky. It was when they were offered microcredit. And so they had money in their hands to go do this business or whatever it was, but it didn't have the sufficient sort of financial training, financial education training, the mentorship, the sort of social network that's required to go forward with a chunk of money and know what to do with it. So a lot of those girls were sexually harassed, whereas we had a different arm of the program where they met every week in a group, they received mentorship, they improved their skills, they had a network with each other, and those girls did not experience riskier behaviors or more harassment, whereas the girls who didn't have the group part and only the financial part did. And so, again, that wasn't savings, but it was microcredit. And so, you can do things in different ways and have the result be positive or negative in terms of risk behaviors. So, and what was your first part of? Oh, yeah, absolutely, the social capital piece. We have shown that social capital for girls really does increase with the group dynamic. And what I've seen also in my research is that girls get more socially connected, not only amongst themselves, but also in the community, and people start to look at girls very differently. Like in one example, the girl, because she was financially literate, she was asked to be the treasurer in the church. It's like, this girl knows how to handle money. And so people start going to these girls for advice. So they're seen very differently when they do become more financially literate and connected to each other.
We've seen the same thing where we have financial education a lot of times, well, not a lot of times, all the time, was delivered in group classroom style. And that did provide a lot of motivation around the savings. And in some cases, in one country, our partner bank actually set up a group option. So you could open a master account for a group. But in all the other cases, it was individual savings. But we found that getting the motivation of the group could be as well through financial education as the actual savings mechanism. And we're involved in a project right now, actually, in South Africa, where we have both options, both savings groups and it links to individual accounts. And there we find it really varies, and it's not either or. Depending on the level of trust among the group members, they might be saving in the group and want to open individual accounts when they are of age. That's what we're seeing, is that the younger kids can't. The legal age of ownership is 16 in South Africa. But when they can, they open those up as well. Other questions? Yes. Mike? Oh, sorry. Okay, one more from the web and then back to the room.
Yes, there's one from Herhard saying developing the business through customer centricity. If you could elaborate a little bit more on that. And then there's another question about other venues to reach children other than schools, like places of worship or some other location that could help in this research.
Well, the customer centricity focus is an interesting one in that we have to ask ourselves, why is it important to focus on the customer versus focusing on the product? And we've used a savings example for youth here, but basically, if you think about it, that we have in most financial services that we provide to poor people, we have high levels of inactivity and non-use. It is a massive problem. And not the inactivity, Lisa, that you described, but when it becomes real dormant, when people walk away from their account, and we have to ask ourselves, why is that? And it seems to me, and based on sort of comprehensive research that we've done, that there are two basic reasons. One is that we tend to really not focus on the client when we actually design these accounts. So it's as if we take something from somewhere else and say, this is a product that we can roll out here, and the microfinance world is notorious for that, where you have a product and you just sort of dish it up to the clients and say, we have the product, they will come, and they don't come. So that absolute focus on the client, understanding what they want, and not asking them, what financial service do you want? But asking, what are the pain points in your life that we need to address? Okay. And then from there on, get to some sort of solution. The thesis is that will be far better to get people to up their uptake and to up their usage. And once again, if you up your uptake and up your usage, then you get sort of revenue for the service providers, and then they will stay in the game. So the whole thesis, to the person on the web webinar question, the whole thesis is to start your thinking with the client rather than start your thinking with the product. So that's the answer on that.
So I'll answer the second question on the community service organizations and religious institutions, and that's absolutely correct. So that goes back to the whole integrated services, and I just think about our education sector. So when we are trying to reach out the most marginalized, we have in our program design, it's already assumed, besides building PTAs, building school management committees, we also build out community organizations to reach out so that they would be responsible to reaching out to these marginalized and finding where they are, and those who drop out of school, why they drop out of school, and to bring them back into the fold. And we also, and especially in Africa, like that you have a divide, right, in some part where you have the Muslim population, where a lot of times our education stats are very low, especially for girls in those populations, especially in Africa. And so, particularly in Africa. And so when you see that, we go out and reach out to the madrasas, to the imams within, in our, education program design. So immediately I think, oh my goodness, we need to do more integrative type of designs in our services in doing that. Because education naturally, in our sector, we naturally think about the most marginalized. And because we have these problems with dropout and retention, we're looking how we can reach them and doing so. That's, I think, my take on it. Okay. Any other thoughts? Okay, more questions.
Hi, I'm Jaya. I work with UNICEF in Nepal, and I was with the Youth Safe Project earlier. My question is to Kelly, and this is around if you've had any experience of possible backlash when the girls become financially empowered in their communities, if there's been any kind of resistance from the men in the society who don't like the girls standing up for themselves, taking decisions. And have you been doing any kind of work with the boys and men, and how that helps? Has there been any significant evidence around that area?
Hi, Patricia Langan from Save the Children. I was intrigued by the connection people are trying to make between improving financial capability and employment outcomes. And I want to direct my question to Ronnie, because I know you're moderator, but I was wondering if you could just give us a hint about what Save is going to do looking forward to make that connection.
Kelly.
So
I did have one experience with a program in South Africa, and it was working with both boys and girls, but the girls really did sort of take this financial education and empowerment and savings, and they were going for it. And a lot of the community was like, whoa, like, what's going on here? And we had to tone down the project because the community was just like, what are you doing to our girls? You know, they're not our girls anymore. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it really does take a kind of stepwise approach, maybe. And I mean, that's a little bit discouraging, but, you know, you don't want to, I guess, upset the local context too much. So that was one experience that spoke to your question. But a lot of the population council programs work only with girls, but I have worked quite a bit with both boys and girls. And what I found is that because, as in your results, boys are more likely to have IDs, boys are more spatially mobile, the boys are much better able to open savings accounts. Girls often try, but because they don't often have the spatial access and or the ID documents, they are not always successful in opening the accounts. We also found that boys get really bored with financial education before the girls do, and so you need to engage boys and girls differently to really keep them in a program.
So I'm going to answer Patricia's question, actually touching on what you just said as well. So we are, Save the Children, our next step, you know, building off this conversation about integrated services, this is really how we see the youth savings agenda going forward, be it through formal banking or other financial institutions, be it through groups. I think there's a very strong argument for both, depending on the context. But we really, you know, as a child-focused organization and one that really tries to address multiple needs of children and young people, we see this as part of our toolkit. It is a good in itself, but also as a potential tool to meet the multiple development needs of young people. So in Vietnam, for example, that we're doing the research to see how financial capability building can improve employment outcomes in a pre-existing program that we've had running there. And one thing that's interesting about that piece of work is that we're actually not even focusing on the savings mechanism, because we learned from our youth save experience and actually did do better research this time, more human-centered research that looked not only at what kinds of products the kids might need, but also what are the pain points in their lives? What are they concerned about? How do they spend their time? And what we found out is most of them have accounts already. They're just not using them because they are badly designed. But what we may be able to do is activate the youth by going where they are already. And what that has meant in this program is going to Facebook and hitting kids. God, I'm repeating something that happened yesterday. Touching kids at multiple points in their day through Facebook, through training, through their peers, and really activating those channels to reiterate those messages and spur the use of channels that they have already. And we didn't do that so much in YouthSave. You know, our market research, it was very interactive, very participatory, but really focused a lot on what kinds of savings accounts might these young people need. And in retrospect, focus less on where are they and what might be the access barriers. And I think the results really bear that out, because as you saw, we have 56% boys, 44% girls across the four countries, but really varying by country, more or less equal or slightly more feminine in Ghana and Colombia, but 2/3 boys and 1/3 girls in Kenya and Nepal. And so I think, you know, taking into account those spatial mobility constraints that Kelly, bringing it back to what you were saying, is going to be really critical in any future implementations that we might have. And we actually have qualitative research going on right now in Kenya to find out why, and this is a really interesting thing, once the girls are in those savings accounts, they perform the same as boys. Yes, in some countries, boys have more savings, but at a general statistical level, the performance is pretty much the same. In some countries, actually in Nepal, I think the girls even saved more. So once they're in those accounts, they do just as well. But then why aren't we getting as many girls into those accounts in some countries? So those are the kinds of barriers that we'll be accessing and sort of addressing in the next generation.
Okay. How much more time do we have? We have questions. Sorry?
All right, let's do one more question in the back, and then how many are there questions on the webinar? Two more. Okay, I think let's take all three, and then we'll address them at once.
Well, it's a comment building on what Rani was saying. We have an experiment in South Africa, and we are looking at soft skills, hard skills, internships, and savings towards employment outcomes. And it's a cluster randomized experiment, and we'll be teasing out, it's actually funded by Ford Foundation, and we'll be teasing out which one has more impact. So watch this space.
Thank you. Hello. So, sort of similar to what Rani was earlier just talking about, based on current research data, how are you rethinking or tweaking programs with regards to partnerships and delivery vehicles moving forward? And there's another one about discrimination of girls and women seem to have been generalized as if it is a cultural or universal. But we know that girls are treated equally or even have higher power in certain cultures. Has anyone seen the difference in other cultures? One about the culture and one about the program going forward.
Well, we've talked a little bit about how we've tweaked our programs. Janet, I'd be interested in hearing whether you have any sort of interim learnings from the 21 bank pilots that are going on right now, and what sort of intermediate redesigns or tweaks might have come out of those observations.
It's complicated because we had 9 originally, and then we just added another 12. So we just started working with the 12. It's a sort of a phase 1 and phase 2. I would say that the 4 models that we talked about, the branch and the in-school banking, are sort of more dominant. The in-school banking, there's a lot of discussion about how credibility, are you in the cafeteria? Are you in the, it's almost access. And also a lot of discussion about engaging with parents and whether you take deposits in the school and then bring them back to the branch, or whether you send the parent to the branch with the child. There's a lot of discussion about that multi-generational communication and engagement of the school in that process. I mean, do you put a flyer in the backpack, or do you make a website that everybody can go to? There's a lot of experimentation going on. So what we've learned is that people are trying different things, but that getting the attention of overtaxed parents is not easy.
From what we've seen, that around the world. To go ahead and wrap it up then. Please join me in thanking our panelists for, I think, what's been a fascinating discussion. And before we let you all go, I am so pleased to introduce our last speaker of the day. He's a gentleman who's been really one of the leading lights of the work in the asset building field, both domestically and internationally, for much of the last 2 decades. Frank DiGiovanni is currently a senior advisor to the president at the Ford Foundation. Previously, he served as their director of financial assets, leading Ford's worldwide efforts to build financial assets for disadvantaged people with support through grants and program-related investments. In this capacity, he supported some seminal work proving that low-income people were as or more likely to save as wealthier people when faced with the same incentives and institutional arrangements. And his grants have helped document these myth-shattering findings both in the U.S. and around the world. Before joining Ford, Frank was associate professor and senior research associate at the New School for Social Research in New York City, and served as the chairman of the Pratt Institute's Department of City and Regional Planning for Brooklyn, where he also taught and consulted on projects in housing and community development. Frank has a PhD and a master's degree in regional planning, both from UNC at Chapel Hill. Please extend a warm welcome to Frank DiGiovanni.
Thank you very much. I'm really incredibly pleased to, my voice is not doing great today, to have the opportunity to share closing remarks with you today, because I believe that providing savings accounts to children and youth is very important for both developmental and normative reasons. And before I should just say at the outset that I'm going to talk about providing savings accounts to children and youth for children starting at birth and for youth through age 18. And I'm going to talk about providing accounts to children partly for two reasons. One, because I think most of the knowledge that we have is for children, and also because I think it really is important to start with really to start at an early age. And also, before I start, I think it is, I really feel obliged to provide an incredible round of applause to both the MasterCard Foundation for starting this incredibly important research, but also to the team of people who've been involved for 5 years, to Save the Children, to CGAP, to the New America Foundation, to the Center for Social Development at Washington University, with whom I've worked for I don't know how many years now, to Michael Sheradin and his team there, and also to Gina and her team at the University of North Carolina, and then to the researchers in all of the countries. This has been a monumental undertaking. As a former researcher who conducted a number of demonstrations, and now someone who has funded demonstrations in over 10 countries, I know how incredibly difficult it is to do demonstrations in a number of places, to keep them on track, and then to do the research. This has been a really monumental undertaking. I give you a lot of credit for it. So congratulations. So I'm going to focus on two major topics in my remarks. First, I will briefly describe the involvement of my organization, the Ford Foundation, in conducting research on children's savings accounts in both the U.S. and in South Africa. And then I'm going to try to briefly answer four questions. First, can children's savings accounts have powerful impacts on children, youth, and their families? Second, I'm going to try to answer the question that Tricia asked, that is, are the savings behavior meaningful? Third, what factors seem to encourage savings? And fourth, what are some of the key unanswered questions that we have? So let me start with what the Ford Foundation has done, because I think this is important context. It'll help you understand my answers to some of these questions. The Foundation began working on children's savings accounts more than 13 years ago. Our goal was to develop a national system of universal progressive savings accounts for children in the U.S. This is not a minor goal. And so far we haven't managed to succeed, but we're making headway, I will say. The centerpiece of this work was what we call the Savings for Education, Entrepreneurship, and Down Payment Policy and Practice, or the SEED initiative for short. SEED had three major components. The first were 11 small community pilots in preschool, elementary, middle school, and high school in urban and rural settings, and each of these pilots provided about 70 accounts each. The second component was one large pilot of 495 accounts for 4- and 5-year-olds, evaluated through a rigorous quasi-experimental design for 4- and 5-year-olds in Head Start centers in Pontiac, Michigan. We called this SEED Michigan. And the centerpiece was a randomized controlled trial of more than 1,300 children's savings accounts provided to children at birth in Oklahoma. We called this SEED OK. In this demonstration, impacts were measured for the children after 4 years, and this is the only test of a universal, progressive, opt-out model of kids' savings accounts today. So again, universal, provided to every child at birth, opt-out, accounts were provided to kids at birth, they were provided, they weren't chosen, they didn't have to select, everybody got one. So this is, again, a test of what would happen if a country gave every child at birth a savings account. What were we trying to learn from this? Is it possible to implement a universal progressive system of children's savings accounts? This was the test in Oklahoma. What are the impacts of savings accounts given to children and their families? And then what design features work best? That's what we did in the U.S. Now, what are we doing in South Africa? We currently have underway a 4-year randomized controlled trial of 1,500 families who received the child cash grant, the children's cash grant program in two provinces in South Africa. For those of you who don't know South Africa, the child cash grant program is the largest cash grant program in the country, given to more than 11 million families, the caregivers of very poor children between the ages of 0 and 18 years old. These are, again, very poor families. And these grants are given to caregivers. Many of the caregivers are grandparents, children whose parents either don't live with them or who are deceased. And if you remember the slide that Kelly gave, in Southern Africa, more than often 26% of the children do not live with their families. This study has a three-pronged design. Two treatment arms. One treatment arm gives just financial literacy training. The other treatment arm gives financial literacy training plus youth development workshops. The second component are facilitated access to bank accounts. And then the third component are matched savings incentives. The goal of this study is really to combat the incredibly high youth unemployment rate of 63%. The goal is to see whether providing a bank account, incentives to save, training in financial literacy, and youth development services will encourage families whose children in the family are 16 years of age, will increase the likelihood that they will transition to either college or university, getting a job, or starting a business. This study is now in the analysis phase, and we hope the results will be ready by March. So let's now turn to the first question. Can children's savings accounts have powerful impacts? My answer to this is an unequivocal yes. In the SEED Oklahoma study, the U.S. randomized control trial, families in the treatment group opened accounts and saved significantly more than the control group. The preliminary results from South Africa indicate that the percentage of families saving regularly in a bank account increased faster than for the treatment families than for the control families. And as we just saw in Ghana, the results indicate that the treatment youth both took up accounts, opened accounts, and saved more than the youth in the control group. Now let's look at psychosocial and educational effects. And again, for me, the answer is an unequivocal yes. In the U.S., the children's savings accounts have statistically significant positive effects on socio-emotional development for children at the age of 4, and the effect was greater for low-income children and for children with less educated mothers. Secondly, the savings accounts improved the mother's expectations for their children's education, significantly greater for treatment than for control families. And very interestingly, this is something I never would have thought, they also reduced maternal depressive symptoms, especially for low-income and less educated women. Now, very surprisingly, all of these effects resulted from the automatic opening of the accounts and partly from the subsidized deposit and were unrelated to the actual savings behavior of the parents. So again, it came from the opening of the account, not from the actual savings behavior. And in the pilot studies, the case studies where the accounts were provided to teenage participants, qualitative research indicated that the accounts helped the teenagers imagine a future with new educational or occupational options. Now in South Africa, the preliminary findings indicate that treatment households, again, caregivers with children between the ages of 16 and 18. The study began when the kids were 16 years of age and in secondary education. The treatment households reported increases in education as the primary reason for saving, while the control families did not. And in fact, over the 3 years where the study is tracking the families, expectations of education, future education, declined for the control families. Treatment youth identified more ambitious future life goals, with 96% of treatment 12th graders aiming to attend college or university, significantly greater than the percentage of control group youth who aspire to this goal. And finally, for treatment students who have already completed secondary school, youth in the financial services treatment group are more than 2 times likely to be successfully enrolled in college or university or currently working than the control group. This, again, is given the aims of the study, is a very powerful finding. Now, when I look at the Ghana study, and again, I only had time to read it quickly before coming here, the impacts on psychosocial or educational outcomes in Ghana, again, as Gina said, were mixed. The treatment group youth experienced increases in future orientation and aspirations for the future, but the differences were not statistically significant. Now, again, they were tracked only for, I think, a year or two. My hypothesis, and I would love to talk to Gina more about this, I think the difference between South Africa and Ghana may very well lie in the nature of the intervention, and I'll get back to this. It may be also the time they were tracked, but I think it may have something to do with the nature of the intervention, and I'll come back to this at the end. Let's now turn to the second question. Is the savings behavior meaningful? And part of me hates to even ask this question because, frankly, I've been doing this work for 13 years, and this is the question we get asked all the time. Everyone thinks the purpose of kids' savings accounts is about how much do you save. And while this is really important because material gains are important because people want to have savings to invest in college education or, in the case of developing countries, it's often you need savings to go on to secondary school. But I honestly don't think that savings is necessarily the most important outcome. I think the psychosocial gains are as important. But everybody asks this question. Policymakers focus on this as the most important outcome, so we have to address it. But frankly, it's the most difficult question to answer precisely because there are no widely accepted norms about what is meaningful or what is successful. They just don't exist, and I have spent a lot of time trying to answer this question. So in the U.S., the percent of families with young kids that actually saved for college ranged from 8.3% in the Oklahoma experiment to 33% in the Michigan. Now, I should point out that in Oklahoma and Michigan, the demonstration, the savings accounts that were provided to the children were in 529 college savings accounts, which meant that the children had to use the savings to go to college. 529 plans, the savings are restricted for use in college. So, 8.3% in Oklahoma, 33% in Michigan. Now, to me, these rates seem meaningful when compared to possible benchmarks, and I'm going to offer you three. 16% of all U.S. households contributed to an IRA, an individual retirement account, in the year 2011, the last year for which we have data. 14% of Americans with incomes below $25,000 owned an IRA in 2012. Only 3% of all families in the U.S. have put money into a 529 college savings plan or an ESA or a Coverdale educational savings account. So think about that. In Michigan and Oklahoma, 8.3% saved, 33% of Head Start families saved in Michigan compared to 16%, 14%, and 3%. I think the savings we achieved in Oklahoma and Michigan are comparable to these. So I think savings in the U.S., very successful. Let's look in South Africa. In the South Africa pilot, 53% of the treatment group families opened an account, and more than 60%, these are, again, very, very poor South African families. 53% of the treatment group families opened an account, and more than 60% saved regularly in a bank account each month. To me, this is incredibly impressive because these are very poor families. Ghana, the take-up rate, as I understand it, for the two treatment arms range between 11 and 21% for the account. This seems very meaningful, especially if we compare this to the take-up rate for many microfinance products. Now, if we look at the amount saved in the U.S., it was a mean average of $100 per year for very low-income people in the U.S. In Ghana, the mean, looking at the report, was $38 per year. Was it per year or for two years? 2 years, okay. So $38 for 2 years. Again, where 48% of the youth were below $2.50 $2.50 a year. That to me is very meaningful. In South Africa, the average savings was $68 after 2 years. Again, for very poor families. These seem to me very meaningful results. And especially when you think that these amounts will compound and grow. But here I think it's very important to bring in a discussion about expectations. There's a growing belief supported by a number of people, supported by the findings about the impact of children's savings accounts on future orientation. There's a belief, a lot of it resulting from the research of Willie Elliott, that holding a savings account, especially if it is dedicated for a specific use and having some assets, may be more important to youth and their families than the actual amount of the savings. And let me elaborate on this. Using secondary data from longitudinal data sets on youth in the U.S., Willie Elliott, who's a researcher at the University of Kansas, has found that even a small amount of savings, as low as $500, increases the likelihood of attending and graduating from college. He has hypothesized that mental accounting, designating savings from college, helps children develop a conception of themselves as college-bound and creating a college-saver identity. According to the theory of identity-based motivation, designating savings for college, regardless of the amount, indicates that college is the goal, and that the child sees savings as the vehicle to make this happen. It is possible that expected savings, not current savings, might be the major motivating factor. So this really raises the whole issue that it may not be the actual amount of savings you have, but how much you may have over time, and the identity this creates for yourself that really is the driving factor. Now again, this is theory. This came from longitudinal data. It hasn't been tested through a randomized controlled trial. But it really gives us the inkling, the link between future orientation, actual savings, and outcomes. And we need to test this more rigorously. Okay, now I'm coming to my third question. What factors seem to encourage savings? And many of these have already been talked about by Lisa, by Gina. So three sets of factors are critical. And because we are so interested in the U.S. and the role of public policy in creating savings accounts for children, I'm going to start with public policy. And I believe that we haven't looked at this enough in our developing country work. Certainly our South Africa work, our demonstration is a partnership with the government of South Africa. And so there we are looking at it. So first, I think we have to look at opt-out structures. Frankly, there's been so much work among behavioral economists in looking at nudges. We really have to look at this whole issue of opt-in versus opt-out. So I think opt-out structures are incredibly important. We've already heard discussion about ID requirements. Minimal or no ID requirements are incredibly important. I know in the U.S. this is going to be heresy with the know your customer rules. But I think we have to look at ID requirements. We've had major issues in the U.S. with trying to provide immigrants with savings accounts because they can't come up with IDs. Supportive regulatory policies are very important. And then savings incentives. We've seen in Nepal that savings incentives made a difference. We know in the U.S. from all the work we've done on individual development accounts and children's savings accounts, savings incentives do make a big difference. Characteristics of financial products. Again, no or minimal deposits, initial deposits make a huge difference. Minimal deposit requirements are barriers to people opening savings accounts. I know there's a debate, but I believe that withdrawal restrictions are important because it does, first of all, it keeps money in the savings accounts, and some people are very motivated. We've done research. People have told us, you know, I love withdrawal restrictions because it means my family can't get their hands on the money. We've been told time and time again that, you know, if I start to save, my brother, my sister-in-law, my cousin, they believe it's their money. They believe they can just come to me and ask for the money. Having a withdrawal restriction protects the money. There are trade-offs, obviously, and we've seen that in the Youth Save demonstration. And I think it's important. I think, Lisa, you made the important point. We need to think about different kinds of accounts. Transaction accounts are important because people do need money for immediate uses. But Many of us believe that savings accounts for developmental purposes, starting a business, buying a home, saving for secondary education or tertiary education, are really important. And finally, what I call digitizing accounts, electronic transfers, creating using mobile technology is really important. And I understand that many youth don't have access, but in the use of cell phone is now so prevalent in developing countries that I believe looking at electronic transfer and mobile money is really important. And finally, facilitating savings is really important. Promoting financial capability is really important. Encouraging parental involvement, maximizing outreach to youth, what I call high-touch programs. Now, again, this has an impact on how do you scale it, but I'll get to that in a moment. Encouraging youth and families to set goals. A lot of the work we've done in working with very poor families in another demonstration we call the graduation program, getting people to visualize the future is a huge motivating factor because they can see an alternative vision to their current reality. And frankly, beginning with as young a population as possible, we've already heard this talked about today, for very practical reasons, money compounds. Okay, finally, I may be running over my time, and I apologize for that. Once I get going on this, you can see how I get excited about it. I've worked on it for 13 years. This is really a very exciting area. Okay, we know a lot, but we don't know a lot. Frankly, I think we know less than there are more gaps in our knowledge than we actually know. Okay, so what don't we know about savings behavior? I think you can see from today's conversation we need to better understand why people open accounts but don't save. Is it due to income constraints? Is it due to lack of motivation? Is it due to future orientation? Is it due to lack of access to financial institutions? Is it due to poor product design? CGAP's client centricity is a huge, huge important topic. Is it due to poor financial capability? Is it due to lack of trust in financial institutions? Is it due to the behavior of bank staff? We have horror story after horror story in our South Africa demonstration about the insensitivity of bank staff in working with youth. All of these are possible explanations, and frankly, I think all of them are partly responsible. We also need to understand the relationship between opening an account and the other outcomes. Is savings necessary to produce these other outcomes? We learned in the Seed Oklahoma that in fact, saving may not be necessary to producing some of the psychosocial outcomes. Secondly, if children's savings accounts, if youth savings accounts are provided at significant scale in specific geographies such as schools, do interaction effects occur that promote increased savings, the social capital argument? I think this is really important, and we need to do much more research on the dynamics in these kinds of places. Third, do various impacts manifest themselves at different ages or different time periods? How long does it take for different effects to show up? Is measuring effects after 2 years fair? Do effects, are effects linear? Are they geometric? We don't have any idea. We really need a theory of life cycle effects to understand this. We need to know the future expectations for the psychosocial impacts for the level of savings. Frankly, we just don't have enough demonstrations to be able to answer this. Turning to the role of expectations, what's the relationship between future orientation, the amount of savings, and the outcomes, such as getting a job or entering and completing tertiary education? I think we really have to give a much more rigorous test to the hypotheses that Willie Elliott has identified. And then the role of product design. Which product features are most critical? How do we convince financial institutions to scale kids' savings accounts? The work of CGAP is very important. I'd hate to believe that there is no business case to be made, but that may very well be the case. And then are there innovative structures beyond the traditional individual account structure? For example, we've been doing a lot of work around retirement plans. There's now some innovative designs to offer retirement plans to try to get around the same kind of issue, which is the business case. For example, in California, there's now a very innovative business model around offering pooled retirement vehicles, which gets around having a retirement account for the individual, where the plan, it's a pooled structure, so which makes it much more attractive to the fund managers. And then finally, using technology to build financial capability. How do we use mobile technology to reduce the cost of facilitating outreach? For example, we've been doing a lot of work in Latin America to work with governments to integrate savings components into their conditional cash transfer programs. And in doing that work, we realized that it's not just enough to provide the conditional cash transfer payments to poor families through bank accounts. We needed to build financial capability, and it was very costly to do this one-on-one. So our grantee developed a program to teach financial capability. They loaded the program on iPads with indestructible cases, and they provided the iPad to lead mothers in villages. They left the iPads with the mothers with these programs with very attractive cartoons, and the mothers taught themselves. You know, you could imagine leaving these iPads in schools, having the kids teach themselves. So there are creative ways to begin thinking about how to do this at scale that is much more cost-effective. So where does this leave us? You know, in the U.S. now, there's a lot of experimentation. San Francisco now is offering children's savings accounts to every child in kindergarten, providing a $50 deposit. So every child in kindergarten in San Francisco now gets a child savings account. Cuyahoga County is doing the same thing. States like Nevada, Rhode Island, Maine are providing children's savings accounts to every, in Maine, it's every newborn. So there's a lot of experimentation going on. I'd love to see this begin to happen in developing countries. I think we need to think about how to integrate children's savings accounts into the national financial inclusion strategy that many countries are developing. I think we need to think about how to integrate these into the social protection plans that many, how do we do this into conditional cash transfer schemes. So I think we need to be more creative in thinking about how to do this. How do we link this into workforce development schemes that Suzanne talked about? So there's a lot of ways for us to think about this. So I think this is only the start. I hope MasterCard will continue thinking about this. And I love it that Save the Children is doing this as well. So again, thanks for the opportunity to make closing remarks. I love this work. Continue it, please.
Thank you so much, Frank, and thank you to all the panelists. I think today's discussion was rich and insightful. If you look on your seats, there is an agenda. On the other side is a survey. We do care about your feedback and sort of how we did and what you learned and takeaways. So please do take a moment to fill that out. And then I also want to make a plug for all the publications on the back table over there. Do grab it when you go out. All right? Thank you so much, everyone.